Title of this talk is I Am the Love I Seek. After listening to the last presenter, which was so clinical and scientific and very rigorously addressed, my talk is going to be a little bit more of the heart. And so what I would like you to do for a moment is simply to take your hand and place it over your heart and recognize that the heart beats continuously without your conscious awareness and in effect is your touchstone to your life. So often when we are in our activities, whether we're passive and listening to a speaker or learning something or actively doing something, we're in our heads. And there's a great deal to be said about using the intellect and looking at things analytically and determining what you want to do next. But when it comes to the quality of your life, it's your heart that is the receptor to both the divine and the ordinary. So I have a little quote I'd like to read. It says, this is something I wrote several years ago, "Most of us secretly know that our life is supported, is purposeful, and offers a promise of magnificence. Nothing outside of us can substitute for this. I'd like to tell you briefly a little bit about myself, and then I'll introduce this video. I was born to parents who divorced when I was an infant, and I was placed in 4 different boarding schools and didn't come home to live with my mother until I was 12, permanently. I learned that outside authority, which was the environment of boarding school, didn't really have a whole lot of interest in me personally. And it was difficult for me because I wanted so much to be touched, to be wanted, to be appreciated, to fit in. And once I recognized that I wasn't going to get the love that I wanted, or that I yearned for, I shut down. I stopped feeling. I stopped expecting love. At one point I was in a foster home, and my mother, who was working full-time assembling tanks during the war, would tell me that she would come out to visit me on the weekend, on a Sunday, and oftentimes she wouldn't show up. And I used to wait all week for her to come. And there would be a phone call. And sometimes she would talk to me directly, and other times she would just relay the message that she wouldn't be able to make it that day. And it was very, very painful. And she was the love object in my life. I was born to Jewish parents, but because of my mother's connection to Christianity, she had a degree in music from a seminary, taught by nuns. She placed me in Christian boarding school. And I was the only Jew in the school. I went to a Catholic school, Baptist school, and Protestant school. Now that sounds kind of harsh, but it was the placement that occurred for me in my life. I was born, like all of us, most of us, came through the birth canal, a wonderful, majestic swim between the sperm and the ovum, and united from parents, and grew into a child, apparently with no control over any of that, but following and going along with the biological program, or perhaps the spiritual program. But when my mother would not show up, and this was an intermittent thing, I never knew when she would really show up or when she wouldn't, I shut down feeling. And I used to get very tense on Sundays because I didn't know what to expect. I could go on and on about my childhood, but I'm going to just short-circuit that in view of the fact that we started about almost 20 minutes late, to say to you that when I was 12, I came home to live with my mother, and I went to high school, went to college, and then after 2 years, I was drafted into the Navy. And when I went into the Navy, I was a perfect candidate for institutional life. I knew how to function in a setting where things were prescribed, precise, very little bending of the rules. In fact, there was an art in breaking the rules, if you know what I mean. But I was a person who wanted to be safe, and I didn't want to break any rules in the military. I, at some point, was put into an air squadron. And the air squadron was deployed on an aircraft carrier. And my job was a plane captain. I was one of those fellows that got up with the pilot, strapped him into his plane, his seat, armed his missiles, armed his ejection seat, and then, as the plane was readying for flight, I would work through a sequential pattern of helping him determine whether this plane was suitable to fly. He was going to fly. I was his ground support, along with other men as well. But I was the final person who more or less went through a series of tests, hydraulic pressures, flaps, all kinds of gauges, and at a certain point, when that was complete, I would signal him and he would be ready to be taxied over to the catapult. You're going to see this activity on the video. The video is about what goes on the flight deck of an aircraft carrier. One of the reasons I wanted to show it was because of the sound. It's a tremendous, powerful, energized environment where the sound is so deafening that you cannot hear a thing. That's how much noise there is. And then amongst that, there's all kinds of movement. And some of the movement, most of the movement, is precise. But there's always movement that takes place that is unexpected. So to work in this environment, you have to be hyper-vigilant. When I was 20 years old, I was working as a plane captain. And on October 16, 1957, I inadvertently stepped in front of the plane that I was in charge of and it sucks me into the intake. This is while the plane was revving at full power. I want to point out to you that there's some slides that I videotape that follow the video, the action part of the video. One of the slides is of my whole squadron, just the enlisted men. And the camera zooms in on me, and I'm standing underneath, or I should say, in front of a plane, and the plane has the number 212 on it. And the reason that I'm pointing this out to you is because the years that followed my near-death experience was characterized, and continuously do so even today, with what I would call revelations or moments of great light and buoyancy. And it's as if my life speaks to me in light. And one of the things that came to me in meditation was, is that the oneness that we are, the oneness that we are, is within all of the duality that is in this place. It's within it. And I kept writing this down. The one is within the two. The one is within the two. And everything here, as you know, is defined by its opposite. We're here now, we'll go someplace else later. The body has a left side and a right side. You exhale, you inhale. You have a masculine side, which is expressive. And you have a feminine side, which is receptive. And of course, we've come from a dominant gender of opposites. There's the father figure, there's the mother figure. You can see how many ways polarity is reflected. But within all that reflection is this vast oneness. This inexplicable oneness. One day in a meditation, I had a distinct sensation that there is like five dimensions to our journey. Five. It just came to me. Months later, I saw a picture, a postcard, of a baby, about maybe 6 months old, and the baby's thumb was in his mouth like this. My daughter would always do this when she was born. She sucked her thumb till she was like 11. And it was a great worry to me. Because I thought she would go through her adulthood sucking her thumb. But it was as if I was being shown something over and over and over again. And when I saw the postcard of this child, I recognized a total phenomenon. And it was, at the time I saw it as my life's journey. That there were five dimensions to the hand. And of course there's the other hand. It's as if there's a masculine hand and a feminine hand. But the number five was very, very powerfully instilled within my psyche. And there's a picture of me on one of the slides that I'll show on the video, of me in my plane. And I'm inside the intake looking out. I had a buddy of mine take my picture. Months later, I was pulled into that same intake. But underneath that intake is the number five. And that's because my plane number was 205. But they only put the five on this little tab in front of it. And I did not know the significance of that for years. I didn't even notice that the five was there until I got into this meditation. And when we put together this video, I was just knocked for a loop to see how powerful in position this five was, right underneath my body, this field. And of course, the other photo, which shows the men, all of the men, there's like 80 men, the enlisted men. The officers had a different photo taken. And I am standing directly underneath this numerical 212. And I never noticed this before until after the meditation came to me and after and during the process of editing this tape together. So I'm going to turn on the video now. How do we get the lights down? Okay. It's only 10 minutes. You'll get a sense of the feel and the activity, and then you'll see some pictures of me. And then after that, I'll continue. Yes? That's about right. Thanks, Father. Yeah. I'm sorry.
You're the greatest guy that we've ever lived. You're also a guy that speaks love. I got you from another side of the situation. How many people are born in your mother?
Two. Yeah, I resonate with that. I'm very aware that my job was to help somebody else fly. In respect to what I see as our lives and our common experience in life, it's our job to prepare ourselves to fly. And we serve one another in ways that are difficult to be precise about. We're not always aware of how we're serving or how we're being served. While I was in the fourth dimension, which I call the fourth dimension, or another dimension, the ground crew and the doctors and the various personnel that were working around the airplane were busy trying to get me out of that jet intake. I had been pulled in. The intake is about 8 foot long, and my jacket, which was loose that day because it was warm, and I didn't wear the customary sweater that I normally wore. And so we were in the North Atlantic, And it was chilly, but it wasn't that chilly. When you're working, you work up a sweat. And the jacket was loose, and so when I stepped in front of the intake, the jacket was pulled up a little bit over my head, exposed my arm, and when I was pulled in, I smashed my head on what amounts to the axle that the turbine spins around. My arms were flung forward, and we're all tangled up in the turbine. When they tried to pull me out, it was so hot in there, they had to wait for the plane to cool down. They had thought of dismantling the plane to get me out quicker, but they knew that it would take about five guys, at least an hour, to undo all that mechanism and pull the plane apart and get me out. So they just had to wait for it to cool. And they finally did. They pulled me in. A guy crawled in, cut my jacket off, tied rope around my ankles, and pulled me out. And they laid me on the flight deck. And they called for a chaplain. Well, my dog Ted said, Jewish. But the only chaplain that was available was the Catholic chaplain. I'm out of my body, and I'm watching the scene on the flight deck. The Catholic chaplain comes up to my body, kneels down, takes out, he was wearing what we call flight gear or battle gear. He wasn't wearing a collar. He was wearing the foul weather jacket that most of the men wore. But he pulled out a purple ribbon and put it around his... He placed it around his neck, and he was kneeling, and he was reciting in Latin a prayer of last rites. I came into my body, opened my eyes, and looked at him, and said, Father, you're not a rabbi. Don't you know I'm Jewish? And I had no life sign. He was stunned, absolutely stunned. His face was ashen. He just couldn't believe that I was speaking from this death state. And I could feel his angst. He did not want to be the chaplain for a Jewish boy. But he got the nod. I looked at him and said to him, It's okay, Father, you'll do. And then I left my body again. Believe me, I was a lot more comfortable with him as the chaplain than I would be a rabbi. I had zero contact with rabbis, lots of contact with ministers and priests. So he was the right person. But there was this juxtaposition between this whole thing, between my background and the culture and the situation that I was in at the moment, it all came together. They took me down to sick bay, where they had a full operating room, six doctors, corpsmen, who are really maybe nurses. They put me on the operating table. I had no life sign. But Father Fitzpatrick had told them that I had spoken to him. They tried to revive me, and they couldn't. They called him again. He gave me last rites a second time. At some point, they got my vital signs back. I was up in the corner of the room, the compartment. There are no rooms aboard ship. I was up in the at the ceiling height, watching the entire event with almost disinterest. I had no concern. I had no anxiety. I was watching. I was at one minute. I will never forget that experience, because I could feel the energy around the table. Some of the doctors and nurses were upset, stressed, anxious, and others were like determined to bring me back to life. And there was this mixture of attitude, and I felt all of it. I felt that I was the doctors, I was the body, I was the instruments, I was the lighting, I was the entire room. It was as if I was looking at a picture that was originating in my own consciousness. Out picture. I was not in the picture, but it was my creation. And that's how I feel today. Part of me is very much in this world, and I recognize time, space, emotion, history, future. And the other part is connected to this realm that is not defined or created by the world. It's an isness. And it has individuality. I'm one of the individuals. Carl's one of the individuals. We're all one of the individuals. And there is an infinite number of individuals. And yet, we're spawned and held by a oneness that is difficult to speak about. So here we are in this environment where it seems as if life challenges us. It will not just cooperate with our planning, with our preparation, with all of the values that we either like or dislike. We have these surprises. And because I touched that place in a conscious way, I had consciousness. I was aware that I was just fine. I had no body. I saw everything without eyes. And I was radiant. It was as if I was radiating rather than, you know, vibrating within duality. I'm going to stop for a moment now because I've only got 10 minutes left and I have a lot more to say, but I know that you have some questions. I do want to say one other important piece of this. This is very important to me. As I mentioned, I was born to divorced parents. I did not bond with my father. I didn't really know him emotionally and didn't even really see him much at all until I was like 14, and then it was just, he had gotten remarried and he was a nice man and friendly and everything, but we never really connected as father's son. So I had no man in my life in a ongoing current way. At some point, in my odyssey of hospitalization, I was in the hospital for 19 months. I had 5 operations, lots of mishigas about the bones. My bones were broken, pins and grafts, and skin grafts, bone grafts, lots of stuff. But at some point, I was transferred to a veterans hospital. And they wheeled me into a ward that had 5 beds. And in one of these beds, there was a man lying on a board. It wasn't a regular bed. He was lying on a board. The board was about that wide and about 6 foot long, but he was only about 5'3". He was a paraplegic. He was on a frame that they would put him on and rotate him every 4 hours. He was either facing up or he was facing down. And his name was Willie Thompson. Willie was probably 38, under 40, but close to 40. And he was black. And we laughed all day long. All day long, I laughed. Now, I was in a body cast. This shoulder got a very serious infection. They had to put it in a cast. I was in plaster here and plaster. And it hurt me when I laughed. And here I was, recovering from this most intense injury. They told me that I had set the Portsmouth Naval Hospital record for fractures. Those fractures healed within 10, 12 weeks. But I had this bone infection in my shoulder that kept me in the hospital for the rest of the time, a year and a half. And except for the occasional surgeries that I had, which hurt, the only other pain I had is when Willie made me laugh. Because I couldn't, it hurt. Anyway, we basically commiserated every day for months and months and shared a great deal of love. And it was joyful. I didn't really think of it as sharing love because we just did what we did. You know, and we played checkers. And we had these incredible battles playing checkers. They were just, and we would posture and make fun of each other and egg each other on. And it was all like theatrical. And other guys came in and out of that room. They were there for maybe a week. To them, they were in our room. To us, they were in our room. And we just carried on, and I basically healed from an infection that I was told I would always have for the rest of my life. That I should plan on coming to that hospital every year for a surgery, because that's the clinical pattern with this particular kind of situation. And I had it real bad. But I had this wonderful tonic, this energetic thing this envelope of love with Willie. So I wanted to throw in that piece because it was that love, and it was especially important to me, I think, not so much, there were only men in the room anyway. There were women in the hospital, but most of the men were veterans from the war, and in those days there were very few injured, female personnel. But this was a man. And we made fun of each other. And we had these routines that we did. And we would start the routine sometimes with a look, sometimes with a sound. And he would act indignant. And then I would act indignant because he was acting indignant. And we knew it was all a posture, but we played it out. And it was elegant, and it was wonderful. And it was incredibly precious to me. In the hospital. So I want to stop and allow for a few minutes of questions here. Yeah.
Wait. No questions except through the microphone. I'm going to be anal about it.
It sounds like a detail, but it's important to me. When you were first out of your body and the Catholic chaplain first came to you, You said you re-entered your body despite having no vital signs. You spoke...
Despite having...
No vital signs.
Yeah.
And you spoke to him, I'm Jewish, you're Catholic, oh well. Do you remember choosing to enter the body? Do you remember your thought was, or more, it was a feeling, something's wrong, and then you found yourself taking action through the mouth of your body?
More than a second.
A second. And then when you left your body, do you remember that being a choice, or it's just your job was done and spontaneously, I'm looking at it again, I'm not in it again?
More that.
A second. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
First off, I want to make a comment about this program that is designed, and I'm here by force of my wife. But I live your life from a different angle. I have background, Air Force. You had not said about geographical areas, which I'm looking for, because that's the way I relate my life of no love.
Geographical area?
Because of the fact that I relate to the Philippines, and I relate to Pennsylvania, where I was born, and that kind of stuff. You haven't brought that in there, and I understand why you haven't, because that's not important, maybe, to any of us. But in here is about 35 people. I'm making this little dissertation because it's important. And there ought to be everybody in this whole thing. You ought to be a main speaker. Because if there's anybody that could motivate these people sitting in this room, you certainly could motivate. Because you've been there. You've been in a situation where you were forced in by our government. Our government lives today sporadically. I'm a former teacher, I'm a 50-year football coach, baseball, basketball, and track, and all that thrown into the pile, and I came out of a family that got very little love. I learned to love in the last year or so from my own son. To learn to love his own mother when she died. Fortunately, we were at a football game, but we got there. That's what I wrote about the first time I came in here the other day to listen to the main speaker. I sat there and wrote my story like you just did on that video. I am going to write a book, not on this stuff. He's going to write it on esoteric studies and quantum child. I'm going to write it on the baseball history, the physical. You have mentioned in here movement, sound, you laughter. You have great fun, super fun right now doing what you're doing. Even though you feel sad and passionate, there ought to be this room ought to be crowded with people. They ought to praise you for what you've done, not only for yourself, but for your mother, your father, who you've never been in contact with. Most people go live through life and never really experience what you've experienced. Now, my question really is, as I look down here, most of us miss a lot of things. He is a man of the greatest team that ever could be established. He's one of them who went to a black person, which I've coached better than white. They're all over the National Football League. I've coached them, head coaches, New England Patriots, and different guys. I go to the Super Bowl with big money involved with. The point is, he's got right here on here, which is the most dangerous job. My youngest brother, who's a twin, lives the same kind of life you lived on that aircraft carrier. He runs the Indianapolis Speedway. Well, he's the first guy out on the track to a little beeper to hit them. The car is going to hit the wall, and it hasn't even hit yet. They know it's going to hit the wall through the computer. Understand? You sense that
when you saluted that guy and said, "I'll see you, get yourself back here," you assisted the greatest program, just like the astronauts going up there. We just heard Ed Mitchell. We just heard Bruce Lipton. His energy comes from around him. But this guy here is talking about you do it better than you. Last night there was a young man here from the press, Christian press, who was incensed because the Bible wasn't mentioned and Jesus wasn't mentioned. And having grown up with kind of a hodgepodge of Judaism and Christianity, and having had the near-death experience, one of the things that is always with me is the energy of Scripture. The energy of it. Not the literal word, and not the historical figure, but, you know, what is being offered in this wisdom. He cited a passage that says, "Nobody goes to the Father except through me." Now, of course, we know this has been translated 14 ways till Tuesday, but a lot of the Bibles tend to pretty much follow that. Nobody comes to the Father except through me. But they don't say what the Father is, but they do say what the me is Jesus. But my experience is that nobody comes to the truth except through this consciousness. This open-hearted consciousness. The Father is the consciousness. And the consciousness is love. But what I feel we're all being asked to do, and you can see it reviving worldwide in various levels, it's the near-death people are one very important little sector, but we're becoming aware that there's a consciousness that we share, and it shows up in these bodies. And first we decided, or we noticed that there's one set of bodies that are male, there's another set of bodies that are female, and then there's the colors, the various ethnic colors. And then, you know, then there's the history. But here we are, we're emerging. We're emerging and recognizing that we're not limited to these bodies. Somehow, I feel like our lives, our individual lives, hold clues for us as to what our purpose is, as to what our mission is. And last night, the speaker said, or yesterday, one of the speakers said something about service. We want to serve. Well, for me, what we really want to do in an energetic way is we want to join with one another. We want to join. We want to somehow hold hands, in a sense, and support one another. And there's tremendous power unleashed when that is done, and when it's done energetically. So, what thrills me about the conference is the individual stories, because I love the individuality of them. You know, when Raymond Moody came out with that profile, it was almost as if he was saying, well, it's not that what he was saying, but the way it was taken on was that if you have this experience, it has to follow this profile. Well, it was a starting point. It was a good starting point. But if you've been there, or if you've paid attention to the little sparks of light that have come to you over the years, here and there, you recognize that it's an individual thing. I mean, just take a look at this. There's no two people alike. So why would our agenda in this life be precisely the same? So there is a theme to our life, an individual theme. And it is to participate. It is to come forward. But more importantly than coming forward, it's It's the willingness to receive love. And a lot of us have closed down. So, when you close down, you open up. So that's what I'm doing, and I see many people doing it.
You find now that it's easier for you to receive and for you to give since your near-death experience? And where do you see yourself going from here?
Oh yes, it is easier for me. It's a matter of willingness and trust. And you would think that all of us would just gulp down love quickly as possible and ask for more. But I believe that there is, one of my careers was as a psychotherapist. I studied psychology. I really wanted to understand more of life after my near-death experience. I was in denial of my near-death experience almost. I didn't want to talk about it. And you've heard that over and over again too. People don't want to, you know, it's like a secret and you don't even have words for it, let alone tell somebody. And the judgment and everything. It's much more common today, just as divorce is. And I say that because when my mother divorced my father, that was a very courageous thing she did back in 1937. I mean, it was like big. And she did that. So it takes courage to be here. It takes courage to love. But like any other thing, once you get into the action of it, it feeds on itself. And rather than stockpiling it, you begin to realize that love is always present and you can't save it. See, in the material world, we save things for when times get rough. I remember growing up, my stepfather always said, you have to save for a rainy day. Because he grew up in the Depression. You don't have to save love for a rainy day. It's there even in the rain. Even when it doesn't look like it's there. And I had many moments in my life when it didn't seem to be there. But I also honor my life as having been difficult, but I believe that it deepened me in ways that were not evident at the time. You know, we all become kind of like craftsmen of our own lives. We don't honor ourselves enough in that way. Yeah. Yeah. The second part, where do I see myself going from here? I am a speaker, and I have a brochure, and what I like to do is go around and, you know, speak to groups. And for those of you that are interested, it's a little summary of my story and my address. I see myself helping other people prepare for their flight. You know?
Several times during your story, you're moved to tears. And you connected with me. I'm an MBE or myself. And those tears are tears of joy and also tears of frustration for the inability to be able to say it and have it understood.
Yeah.
Is that so with you?
Well, in this group, I don't feel the frustration because I feel as if all of us know that this dimension that we're referring to out of body, you can't really nail it down with words and abstractions and concepts. Although I'm full of concepts. I'm constipated with concepts. I have concepts that don't quit. As I mentioned earlier, I feel like we are on a journey, and the journey is to kind of learn who we are, evolve. And there's a certain framework that I present in seminar where I have a lot more time. But I don't feel the frustration here. I feel honored to be able to participate and encourage other people to speak their truth. And that is exactly it. It's not the truth, it's their truth. And when we hear enough of those truths, we kind of get, you know, it's like the lyrics are not as important as the music. The music is what we're listening to here. And that's why I feel we've come together. Some people are dragged here. The coach was dragged here. Well, that's good. You know, that's very good to hear the music.
Robert, we got to...
Yeah, we're over.
We're over. There's somebody supposed to start right now.
I'll be around most of the rest of the day, so if you want to talk to me, I'm here. If you want one of my brochures, it's here for you. Thank you. I'm happy to be with you.